Good evening. In the fall of 1970, it was my privilege to have been given permission to go to work for the state of Maryland in their Division of Alcoholism Control, and it was there that I met some co-workers who became very good and dear friends. One of them was a lady of almost infinite compassion for the alcoholic, who herself was not one. A social worker by trade, her name was Gertrude Nielsen, and I learned a very great deal from that wonderful lady. She had worked for many years in the field of social work with alcoholics, and she was asked one day by a former employer and colleague to write out what she had learned. And not wishing to impress anyone, she did not stretch it into a book, but wrote it all on one side of one sheet of paper. 10 declarative sentences, a list of do's and don'ts for helping sick alcoholics to get well. Now, I'd like to share them with you this evening. The only thing I've done is kind of rearrange them. She used to refer to them as her 10 commandments. I've simply rearranged them into 8 of these helpful hints. Now, even before I begin, I'd like to make this rather clear. These things are not a magic wand. There's absolutely no guarantee whatsoever that they will work. You know, if you do them, they will work. No, no such thing. What I do say is this, of those things that might work, these might work best because they are the result of experience. Through sheer trial and error, men and women have found what might work with alcoholics and what probably will not work with alcoholics, and Gertrude simply put them down. Now, I'd like to share them with you this evening. There's another thought I'd like to express before I begin. Somebody once said, "It's too bad that I hear myself only with my own ears. I don't know how you will hear me." I know exactly what I am going to say tonight because I've said it many, many times. And I know exactly what the words mean to me. But I'm not too sure you're going to hear them in exactly the same way. I know that. I realize that. That's a handicap of anyone who opens his mouth. There is such a thing as point of view. You see through your eyes, I see through mine. I remember one time I was in the home of a friend out in Seattle, and we were speaking of this very thing, point of view. And I don't know, it was kind of on the spur of the moment. We were sitting on opposite sides of a coffee table, and I picked up a magazine. And I held it between us. And I said, "To show you what I mean, Bill, tell me exactly what your eyes are looking at." He said, "I'm looking at a magazine. It's, I guess about 8x10, has a paper cover, a red border. There is a picture, I think it was the president or some public figure. And above this head are the letters T-I-M-E. Time, and there's a date." I said, "All right, now I'll tell you exactly what I'm looking at." As I'm looking at a magazine, paper covered, has a white border. And on it, on this cover, is a picture of Napoleon mounted on a charger. And beneath this picture is a 4 or 5 line ad for Courvoisier Cognac. We were both looking at the same magazine, but he was looking at it from his point of view, and I was looking at it from mine. And each of us, as far as the magazine is concerned, was just looking at the cover. Neither one of us saw what was inside. So I think that it is important that you remember that as well as it is important that I remember that. So we begin. The first hint or help for the alcoholic that I have to share is this. Adopt proper attitudes toward the alcoholic. Now, underlying that is a very basic and a very simple principle. You are not about to help someone who knows that you despise him. Don't you know when somebody hates you? The alcoholic can be almost unconscious, and he can smell your attitude. He knows whether you care or whether you condemn. He knows that. He senses it. He feels it. Now, this first hint, helpful hint, is at the base of all the other seven that follow. And I will spend most of this talk on this first one, to adopt proper attitudes toward the alcoholic. Now, before I get into attitudes toward the alcoholic, I would like to just make a few comments about attitudes in general, because I think they're almost deathly important. And the first is a very obvious statement of truth. The attitude is the father of the action. The attitude is the father of the action. I function according to my beliefs. The belief is the father of the practice. For example, we are, I presume, fairly intelligent men and women. I would think that we do our jobs intelligently. I would guess that we shop and save and budget and provide for the future intelligently. But in all other realms of living, we are all but governed by our opinions, our attitudes, our preferences, and our prejudices. Face it, what you like and what you dislike determines what you pick from a menu, doesn't it? Doesn't it determine the type of clothing you buy, type of people you associate with, the type of vacations you take? My likes and my dislikes govern a great deal of my behavior. Now, when it comes to people, oh boy, if I like you, I will almost bend over backwards to justify your shortcomings. I don't know who he was. I don't know whether he was a psychologist or just a man with common sense. Whoever it was who first said, love is blind. Somebody added, marriage is an institution for the blind. Have you ever seen a couple, and have you ever said this? You're looking at a couple, and you look at the woman, you look at the man, you say, good heavens, what can she see in him? Love is blind. Now, turn the coin over. If I dislike you, I'm almost eager to believe the worst. Now, I don't want to be that way, but I am that way, so are you, to a greater or lesser degree. Anybody ever bring you bad news about someone you don't like? Watch your reaction to it. Listen to your tone. Oh, he broke his leg. We're built that way. We are built that way. The attitude is the father of the action. And the second thing about attitudes in general is this. We do not have them. They have us. And if you want to prove it, try to get rid of one. I remember one time asking a black officer in one of the branches of our military service. He was teaching in one of the schools. You know, they had these courses in trying to overcome prejudice. I asked him after, I think it was about 3 or 4 years this had been going on, I said, has this accomplished anything? He said, a little bit. Let's take a physical habit. I'll try to show you what I mean. Habit is something that has become a part of us through repetition. We do it over and over again. For example, I get into a sweater, a shirt, a jacket, a coat, right arm first. Now, I can get into one left arm first. Give me about 4 minutes with a little help. I can do it. Take one of your own habits. Every day you get up, you put on 2 shoes. That's not important. You always put the same one on first. That's habit. Habits have us. We don't have them. And if you want to prove it, try to break one. How do you eat, right or left-handed, with the fork? If you eat right-handed, for the next 3 days, do it with the opposite hand. You will not taste your food. You'll be too busy trying to prevent puncturing an eardrum with a fork. What is an attitude? An attitude is also a habit. It's a habit of thinking, it's a habit of feeling, it's a habit of judging. And these attitudes will die about 20 to 25 minutes after we do. He who is convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. They tell a wonderful story about a fellow went to see a psychiatrist, and the doctor said, "What seems to be the trouble?" He said, "Doctor, I think I'm dead." Well, a doctor had never had one of these before, and he worked with that fellow for about 2 hours and got exactly nowhere. He was intrigued with this patient. He said, "Look, I want to see you again." The fellow said, "No problem. When do you wish to see me?" He said, "In a month's time." The fellow said, "Why a month?" He said, "If you're willing, I'd like you to do something for me." And the man said, "Name it." He said, "I want you 3 times a day to stand in front of a mirror and say out loud to yourself, 'Dead men do not bleed.'" He did. He came back at the end of 30 days. He said, "Doctor, I have done exactly as you've asked me to. 90 times. I didn't miss a one. Dead men do not bleed." And the doctor said, "Fine, come here." And he didn't say another word. He took the index finger of the man's left hand, held it, took a straight pin, and jabbed his index finger with the pin and drew a drop of blood. And he pushed it onto the man's face without a word. And the fellow stared at it for a while, and he said, "Good heavens, doctor, dead men do bleed." He got nowhere with him. And that is exactly what we deal with when we deal with attitudes. Now, I'm not a fool. I do not presume to believe that I'm going to change attitudes of anyone in this room within the space of an hour or so. It would be rather presumptuous of me to think that I could change within an hour something that you have spent a lifetime building up. What I hope to do is change your minds, to substitute truth for misconceptions, so that even though your basic feelings and attitudes might remain, you might function a little differently toward the alcoholic, guided now by fact rather than feeling. So let's begin to examine some of our attitudes towards every single facet of alcohol. Well, let's take the first, and I guess one of the most emotional, drunkenness. Drunkenness. Let's examine some of our attitudes towards it. Do you think it's funny? A lot of people laugh at drunks. By the way, it's very significant. We won't go into the significance, but it is significant that alcoholism is the only terminal disease we make jokes about. All right? Some of them are very funny. Some of them are very funny, and we laugh at them. Two drunks walking along a railroad track after about 6 hours, one turned to the other, said, "It's the longest stairway I've ever been on in my life." And the other one said, "It ain't the stairs, it's the low railings that are getting to me." Fellow was walking down a street with a penguin on a leash, and a traffic cop said, "Where are you going with that thing?" He said, "Well, he was tied to a lamppost. He seemed lonely. I thought I'd take him home." The cop said, "Take him to the zoo." 3 days later, he's drunker. He still has the penguin. And the cop said, "I thought I told you to take him to the zoo." He said, "I did, officer. He loved it. Today, we're going to the library." Well, there are all kinds of crazy drunk stories. Now, there's a point to what I'm making here. What is the essence of humor? What is it that you laugh at? Isn't it the twist at the end? No matter what the subject, whether it is race, religion, sex, or alcohol, what is funny is the twist at the end. Now, what I'm getting at is this. Do you see a difference between laughing at a fictional story about a drunk and laughing at drunkenness? Do you see the difference between laughing at a funny story, genuinely funny, and laughing at a woman simply because she's drunk. I remember one time I was in a downtown restaurant in my home city with my young nephew. Two men lifted a third man from the table next to ours and all but carried him out. He was obviously quite drunk. He was really drunk. A woman at a nearby table thought that was one of the funniest things she ever saw in her life, laughed out loud until they got him out the door. My nephew's reaction, he said, "I just don't understand how anybody could drink the amount to put him in that condition." So you see the different reactions to a drunk. By the way, if you really think drunks are funny simply because they're drunk, the next time you're tempted to laugh at a drunk, look at his wife or look at his children and see how hilarious they think he is. Do you think drunkenness is sinful? There are all kinds of people who quote scripture condemning alcohol when the quotes condemn the abuse of alcohol. Now, I'd like to talk about the different kinds of drunkenness. There are two kinds. They're related, but they're worlds apart. There is drunkenness that results from alcohol abuse and drunkenness that results from alcoholism. What is the difference? Whenever you hear the word abuse, you think of freedom of choice. The social drinker, the controlled drinker, can freely choose not to drink at all, drink a certain amount and quit, or to abuse alcohol by getting drunk. Alcoholism results in drunkenness simply because the alcoholic drinks the way he drinks, since he can't not drink that way. He drinks compulsively. He drinks many times against his will. Now, do you think drunkenness is sinful, evil? The paradox that is involved here is this. The abuser gets kind of laughed at a little bit or condoned. And the fellow who gets condemned is the poor old alcoholic, because his behavior is always negative at best, obnoxious at worst when he does get drunk. The abuser could be judged on moral grounds. He is at fault. It's the alcoholic who gets judged. Drunkenness. How about drinking? Just plain drinking, the ingestion of alcoholic beverages. Some people believe that it is all right to drink alcoholic beverages. Some believe that it is not all right, that it is immoral, it is sinful. Now let's talk just very briefly about morality. I'd like to tell you something about morality and me. If I honestly believe that something is bad, morally bad, and you're doing it and I'm not doing it, I'm better than you. I'm simply better than you. If you're doing something that's beneath me, you are. Now, I don't want to be that way either, but a little bit of me is that way. I think a little bit of everybody is that way. We do. It's a wonderful thing to say, condemn the sin, not the sinner, the action, not the actor, the deed, not the doer. But I judge people, and so do you. And we judge people through their behavior. And if their behavior is obnoxious, we judge accordingly. We judge accordingly. Now, for those who believe that drinking is sinful, they have just passed judgment on about 50% of the human race, for whom bread and wine or bread and beer are staples of life. Now, most of you don't really know me. You don't know whether I'm good or bad, basically, in my character. But am I evil because I use wine at Mass? Do you know about four or five major religions of the world actually use wine in the very worship of God? I've been to Europe several times. I remember one time a doctor friend of mine drove me through the marvelous mountains in one area of the Black Forest. And it was up in vineyard country. And I could just picture an old German farmer coming down now off the mountain where he had been tending his vineyard for lunch. And his wife serves him a slab of cheese and a chunk of bread and a glass of beer. And he has his lunch, goes back up into the hills to work until dinner, which he eats, and then goes to bed. He's been doing this for 60 years of his life. Is that man going to hell because he ate lunch and had beer with it? And so it boils down to, what is your basic attitude toward the substance, towards alcohol? Can any inanimate object be evil or good? How about the chair you're sitting in? Is it evil or good? And yet we say things like this, alcohol, what it did to my father, what it did to my mother, what it did. We blame a thing that God has put on this earth. Can alcohol be any more moral or immoral than the floor that your feet are on? Let me show you what I mean by the attitude is the father of the action. Where I believe that this thing is evil, the subsequent action is, I call it that. Demon rum. Devil's brew. The lips that touch liquor will never touch mine. I don't drink it because it's bad, because it is bad. Now let's get to alcohol. Well, I was going to say let's get to alcoholism, but let's get to alcoholics, people who have it. What's your attitude toward the alcoholic? Is he really sick? Is this thing really a disease that he has? Couldn't he really just quit? I can. Our attitudes toward the alcoholic, I want all of you just to answer this. What do you think of a woman who shows up drunk at her daughter's graduation? What do you think of a man who shows up drunk at his mother's funeral? Especially if it's your mother too. And this is the brother who has kept you and your wife and family almost dirt poor because you've had to help support his family. What do you think of a man who gets drunk and takes his daughter to bed with him for sex? Now, I don't care who you are, whether you're an alcoholic hater or whether you yourself are an alcoholic who got well, you cannot look at any of those instances and not have feelings, and very strong feelings about it. I remember once after I was sober many years, I was in a restaurant in which I saw a man slap his wife in front of his three children. And a little girl about 8 years old got up from that booth and walked out. And when he yelled for her to come back, she didn't move a hair of her head. She didn't miss a step. She kept going. My instant reaction inside, I wanted to hurt him because I saw the look on that little girl's face. And it took me a while up in my head to ask this question, would anybody in his right mind have done that? And then I had to put into practice everything I had learned about this disease. Now, we all have kind of negative attitudes towards alcoholics. All of us. And I guess some of them we will go to our graves with. Let me ask you this. What is your instant emotional reaction when you see a drunk? Mine is, it's almost non-existent, but it's there if only for a split second, fear. Do you remember the first time you ever saw a drunk when you were a little kid? I don't mean when you were with a group of kids, because kids are cruel. In a group, they'll laugh at and they'll taunt a drunk. I'm talking about the very first time when you were all alone, you saw a man or a woman staggering. There had to be a little bit of fear, because this is not normal for people to stagger. And the first time you saw it, it had to be a little frightening. I was always afraid of my father when he drank. And to this day, there is a faint, infinitesimally quick feeling of fear every time I see a drunk. And I would suppose that that's true of all of us. And it's awfully, awfully hard to love what you fear. Well, we can beat that to death. The only thing I'm going to say is this. In 1956... the AMA, the American Medical Association, defined alcoholism as a disease, a malady that manifests itself through a set of symptoms. Now, you can do with that what you want. You can believe it, you can accept it, or you can throw it out the window and say doctors don't know what they're talking about. But, I mean, that is the fact. But no matter what my feelings, I still have certain obligations toward my fellow human beings. We'll go into that in a minute. Where do our attitudes come from? Primarily from our parents. We learn everything, basically, from our parents. Our religious background, our ethnic, our racial background. But the strongest source of attitudes toward alcoholics comes from personal experience. Personal experience. Some religions, for example, approve the use of alcohol, some condemn it. They have about equal rates or percentages of alcoholism. We Catholics, theologically, approve the use of alcohol. And somebody once said, where there are four Catholics, you usually find a fifth. We do have a high rate of alcoholism. Among some denominations that forbid the use of alcohol, there's a sky-high rate of alcoholism because those who do drink, drink with guilt. And of those who drink, the percentage is very high indeed. Our parents, of course, if we love our parents, we pretty much adopt the principles that they teach us. And if not, we reach for opposite ideals. But they have had the strongest influence on us. Our racial background, I know a little girl who, she's married to an alcoholic who, thanks be to God, has recovered. But from her earliest days, she grew up in an ethnic neighborhood. And she just knew that when she grew up, she'd marry, as did her mother, a man who would work hard, play hard, and drink hard. And she did. Alcohol, especially beer, was part of her ethnic background. Personal experience. There is hardly a person alive who hasn't been affected to a greater or lesser degree by some alcoholic. Case in point, I knew of a nurse. I don't know her, but another co-worker was putting on a seminar somewhere, and he was asking, what is your definition of an alcoholic? What is an alcoholic? And this woman raised her hand. She said, an alcoholic is my uncle. As an orphan, she had been adopted by an aunt and uncle, and the uncle was a wife-beating, child-beating alcoholic. Her attitudes were predictable. She sees her uncle. In every alcoholic, they wheel into the emergency room, and she's been working emergency rooms all of her career. And she treats alcoholics accordingly. The attitude is the father of the action. She treats them with utter contempt. Now, is her attitude wrong? Well, yes. But is it understandable? Of course it is. Are our attitudes wrong? Yes, the only difference is some are wronger than others. Alcoholism is a mystery. We don't know all there is to know about it. And lacking complete truth, we will function accordingly. Well, what is there to do? Let's just face a simple fact. I am ordered by the God who created us all to love my fellow human beings. I am not put on this earth to judge. I'm good at it, but that's not why I'm here. God has not yet gone on vacation and appointed any of us to fill in. Thou shalt love is an order by God. And I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. You can do with it what you want. Speaking of attitudes, if the primary source of all of our attitudes is parental, where do you think your kids will get their attitudes? It's frightening, isn't it? It's frightening. Well, if I am to help an alcoholic at all, I absolutely have to have some sort of a proper attitude towards him. He is sick. He needs help. Should I not provide some? Number two, learn to recognize the disease through a knowledge of its symptoms. Now, this is one of those truisms. The underlying principle here is, I cannot help you for alcoholism until and unless I see that you have it. You know, if I don't see that you have an alcohol problem, I'm not about, even though my motivation for doing good may be the best on earth, I'm not about to help you if I don't see that you need it. Now, how do we learn about the symptoms of alcoholism? Well, in a fairly easy way, there are books, there are seminars and workshops and schools of alcohol studies. They're multiplied everywhere. Usually a local council on alcoholism will year-long put on some sort of educational workshops and so on in the disease. However, there are pamphlets put out by the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that are the finest literature on earth about this disease. Number one, they're brief. You can read one in about 20 minutes to a half hour. Number two, they're free. And number three, they are written by experts who have been there. How do you learn anything best? Ask the man who owns one. Do you want to know where to learn alcoholism best? From people who have had it and who have recovered from it. They're not cured, but they have gotten well. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous holds meetings in which its members help each other to get and stay sober. The meetings are of two kinds. Some are closed and some are open. The purpose of an open meeting is to invite the public, clergy, medical people, and the public in general who are interested to come and learn about alcoholism firsthand from those who, in an almost ruthlessly honest way, will tell you what happened to them. The basic fundamental pile of knowledge that we have about this disease has come from alcoholics who have arrested it in their own lives. Now, you want to know something about your own attitudes about this disease? Most of you wouldn't want to get caught dead at an AA meeting. I can see non-alcoholics walking in. I wonder who can see me. And when you get in the door, this thought is paramount. How will they know I'm not one?